You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Japanese form of fly fishing is becoming more popular in Wisconsin. We find out why and learn the basics.
First, a new bill would make carrying a concealed weapon without a permit legal in Wisconsin. The legislation advanced out of a Senate committee yesterday. The bill now goes to the full Senate, which could take it up next month.
Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. She joins us now from our studio at the State Capitol. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, spell it out for us, Laurel. What would this bill do?
Well, basically what this bill would do is make concealed carry licenses optional in Wisconsin. So people who want to have a concealed carry license can still have one, but it wouldn't be required for carrying a hidden weapon in Wisconsin any longer.
And talk about the current state of affairs. What would I have to do now to legally carry a concealed weapon in the state?
Well, right now, to carry a concealed weapon, you have to do a couple things. You have to apply for a license. To apply for the license, you have to be at least 21 years old. You have to be a person who isn't prohibited from possessing a firearm by state or federal law. And you have to fill out an application and pay a fee. And part of that application, when it's being processed, is a background check and providing proof that you took a course on firearm safety and firearm handling that has been approved by the state of Wisconsin.
And as I understand it, in this bill, you could carry a firearm concealed legally anywhere you wanted to without a permit, except there's a little bit of asterisk here. What would be the exception?
Yeah. So obviously this law can't preempt federal regulations. So there's the federal gun-free school zones. So you couldn't carry a concealed weapon in places where federal law prohibits it. So schools would be a primary place where they wouldn't be allowed. But the bill would allow people to have, and this is aimed at people who are kind of picking up and dropping off their kids from school, just kind of quick in and out. So it would allow people to have concealed weapons in their vehicle, and I believe within 5 feet of the vehicle, as long as the person within 5 feet of the vehicle was going to get back in the car and leave. So it does change kind of that school language a little bit, but those federal regulations still stay in place.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about legislation that cleared a Senate committee this week, loosening up concealed carry laws here in Wisconsin. What do sponsors and supporters of this bill say about it? Why do they think it's necessary?
Well, sponsors of the bill call it constitutional carry. And they say that, you know, Wisconsin has allowed the open carry of a firearm, so, you know, not concealed, without a permit for a while. So people should be able to carry a concealed weapon similarly without a permit. When I asked for a comment from the sponsor of the bill, who's a Republican Senator David Craig, who represents the town of Vernon, he said that 12 other states allow residents to carry concealed weapons without a permit. And why should Wisconsin have fewer rights? Why should Wisconsin residents have fewer rights than the people in those 12 states?
And how about opponents of the bill in the Senate? What have we been hearing from them?
Well, the opponents to the bill are just generally concerned about eliminating that training that is currently required to get that concealed carry permit. They say that the training is necessary. It's very helpful. The background check that goes through to get the permit as well. There were two Democrats on the Senate committee yesterday, Senator Fred Risser, who represents Madison, and Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee, and they both spoke against the bill.
Here's a listen to Senator Fred Risser from Madison.
I think it's bad public policy. We have a problem in this country with too much liberalization on firearm laws, and this just adds to it.
That said, Senator Risser's in the minority party. So what's the sentiment among Republicans in the Senate? Does it seem like there's support across the party for this?
Well, there is support from one prominent senator we heard from yesterday, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Wongard, said he's really optimistic about it passing not only the Senate, but the Assembly. He showed his concealed weapon that he has. He's a concealed carry permit holder and really supports the legislation and is optimistic about its future. Senator Scott Fitzgerald, who's the Senate Majority Leader, told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel earlier today that he hasn't decided whether or not he's going to bring the bill to the floor. That's something that Senate leadership decides, whether a bill that passes committee ultimately gets to go before the full Senate. Senator Fitzgerald said that he needs to have a meeting with all of the Republican senators to kind of feel out how they feel as a caucus, if Republican senators are going to kind of support this bill as a whole and support it enough for it to get through the Senate.
This is jumping ahead a bit, but if this bill came to Governor Walker from both houses of the legislature, has he given any indication of what he thinks about it, whether he might sign off on this?
Well, this is something that's been circulating in the Capitol for a while. The public hearing on this bill was, I think, in May. So this is something that we have asked Governor Walker about, whether he supports it. And what he said back then was that he thinks the current process with the permit, the training, all of that stuff is appropriate. So at least, you know, within recent months, he sounds like he might not necessarily support this bill. Of course, his position could evolve and the bill can change. If it were to be brought up in the Senate, it could be amended. If it goes to the Assembly, where it hasn't been heard yet, even in committee, some changes could happen there that would make the governor more likely to support it. So we'll just have to keep an eye on it.
What's the lobbyist battle shaping up like? Who's been for and against this?
Right. So there are a lot of different organizations that have weighed in on this bill. There's a fairly strong contingent of school groups that have voiced their opposition to it. Milwaukee Public Schools, the Madison School District. Jen Cheatham, who's the superintendent of Madison Schools, issued a statement saying that she thinks, the school district thinks, that the bill would create confusion, uncertainty, and possibly dangerous situations. That's an exact quote, by encouraging more guns in and around schools. So there's kind of a school group contingent. There's also a mental health and public health group of organizations that oppose it, like the Wisconsin Medical Society. The Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association also opposes it. And then you have the gun groups on the other side, like the National Rifle Association, the Concealed Carry Association, which think that it's a great thing to increase that freedom in the state of Wisconsin.
This is among the first items to come out after, you know, the legislature has been a little busy with the budget and the Foxconn thing. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see a lot of movement on a lot of non-budget type items now?
Well, it's definitely possible. I mean, those were kind of the big items that were sucking the oxygen out of the room. I think it might be safe to say the budget and Foxconn, it was kind of taking air away from other policy proposals. So we'll continue to see more. I mean, there are some things, we just got the veto messages for the budget, things that Governor Walker is going to remove from the budget before he signs it tomorrow. He said that some of those things he removed, he believes should be introduced as separate legislation. So some of those things that were in the budget that are now out of the budget might be reintroduced, and the debates on those things will be renewed in the Capitol. So we're certainly not going to bed now after the budget and Foxconn are done. We've got a lot left to look forward to.
And Laurel, I imagine you're spending the rest of your day doing what anybody would want to do on a sunny afternoon, reading 99 veto items.
Yes, sir. 99 vetoes.
Laurel, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you again, I think, later this week.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
That's Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter. She joined us to talk about the concealed carry expansion bill in Wisconsin. It passed out of a state Senate committee yesterday.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Fall is harvest time in Wisconsin. It's a time of year that reminds historian John Gerda of his own family ties to the land and the ways that farming has changed over the last century.
It's harvest time in Wisconsin. On a recent bicycle trip from Milwaukee to Door County, two friends and I witnessed autumn coming down like a curtain across the eastern rim of the state. The last alfalfa had been cut not long before, and the hay fields looked shaven in the fading light. The oats were already in the elevator, the soybean leaves had turned a vivid yellow, and the corn stalks were trading their supple green for a brittle gold. The scene was bucolic, but curiously devoid of people. Although there were farmers in the fields, nearly all of them were solitary older men on tractors, plowing under the oat stubble or harvesting the corn. The landscape seemed almost deserted, and it occurred to me that we were seeing the culmination of a trend that began well over a century ago, the industrialization of agriculture. I have always felt a strong affinity for farming through my mother, Claire, although it's an affinity tinged, I freely admit, with the helpless romanticism of the city dweller. She was the daughter of a Norwegian immigrant named John Johnson, from Wisconsin, no less, and his wife, the musically named Ella Nicolina Kalbakken. Together, they ran a dairy farm in the rugged hills southeast of La Crosse. When my mother was growing up in the teens and 20s, only the most ambitious farmers plowed more than 100 acres, and 25 cows would have been a very large herd. What has happened since then is nothing short of revolutionary. One of my Crawford County cousins described the change simply. Farming isn't hard anymore, he said. It's just expensive. Fewer people are cultivating more land and reaping greater yields with the help of more reliable seeds, more potent chemicals, and ever more powerful machinery. A tractor alone can cost $250,000, and that's just the start. Small wonder that farmers have expanded their operations to keep pace with skyrocketing costs. Wisconsin's largest dairy farms now have more than 8,000 cows each, milked in a 24-hour rotation and housed in buildings as large as airplane hangars. The scene would be incomprehensible to anyone in my mother's generation. I understand the economics, but it's hard not to feel a pang of loss when the family farm of yesterday has become, in agribusiness parlance, the concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO, of today. There is, fortunately, still a way to experience what farming was like for our ancestors, and autumn is a season to do it. For a month of weekends from mid-September to mid-October, Old World Wisconsin, the outdoor ethnic museum near Eagle, will welcome one and all to its annual Autumn on the Farm celebration. All of Old World's farmsteads will be fully staffed, and visitors will be able to watch within touching distance as crops are harvested, meat is smoked, logs are skidded, grain is threshed, sauerkraut is made, and trees are sawed into lumber. If you're in the right place at the right time, you might even be asked to help. Perhaps we can't go back to the past, but Old World Wisconsin offers the next best thing. It provides a tangible reminder of the vital connection between land and life that sustained our ancestors. If only for a weekend, Autumn on the Farms allows us to renew that connection and return to our own century with a deeper appreciation of the hardships and the pleasures of the Wisconsinites who came before us.
John Gerda is an award-winning historian and author. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, Wisconsin's lakes and rivers are a big draw for anglers of all kinds, but the time and the expensive equipment needed for fishing can be intimidating for newcomers.
But a style of fly fishing called tenkara is gaining a following in the state thanks to its simplicity. Originating in Japan, tenkara doesn't take a lot of gear, and it's easy apparently to pick up, learn, and start catching some fish.
Matt Smendt is the co-owner of Badger Tenkara. He speaks about tenkara around the country, and his writings have appeared in a variety of angling publications. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, how is it different from traditional fly fishing?
Well, tenkara is different from traditional fly fishing, mostly in the fact that it doesn't have a reel. Instead, the line is attached to the very tip of the rod, and that makes it what's called fixed line fly fishing. The line is a specific length and can't be adjusted.
And so how do you reel the fish back in without, you know, the reel?
Well, instead of reeling the fish in, what you do is you tuck in your arm and you lean the rod backwards towards you, which tips the rod back, and you're able to reach out and grab the line and simply pull the fish in back towards you. It's very intuitive.
And I understand one of the remarkable things about the tenkara rod is that they're really, really light.
Yeah, they're about 3 ounces on average, and most of them, although they're about 12 feet long, collapse down to about 20 inches, so they're exceptionally portable as well as being lightweight.
What else is different about the way tenkara works compared to traditional fly fishing in the U.S.?
Well, tenkara is much more focused on technique than on solving problems with gear. So you see a lot less of a focus on changing flies and the what's called match the hatch philosophy that you see in Western fly angling. typically you see a lot of focus on trying to determine what exact bug is coming out of the water in Western fly fishing, and you'll see very large fly boxes full of different types of bugs, and the angler is standing there trying to determine exactly what meal that trout is trying to eat. In Tinkara, you use very simple, impressionistic flies that are going to just give the trout the impression of food, and the angler is incumbent to use different techniques to try to entice that strike. So it's much more reliant on technique than on actually trying to fool the trout with a lifelike imitation.
And I understand that these different Tinkara flies have some pretty fun names. I didn't know that. Could you tell us a few of them?
Well, you have the Japanese word for fly is kabari. So we call the Japanese flies tobaris, and then the most iconic type of Japanese fly is a Sakasa tobari, which is a reverse tobari, meaning that the typical hackle is actually pointed back up towards the angler instead of backwards or in a vertical or a parallel manner, which is pretty common on most Western flies, which allows the angler to use a technique called pulsing. Which means that as they pull the fly backwards towards them, that water pressure will actually open up the hackle, and as they release pressure against that fly, it'll close. So it'll actually flutter open and close, making it look like a little insect trying to swim or escape, which gives you another level of action to entice that trout strike.
I understand that because there's less gear, there's not as many decisions to make about which fly to use. By some accounts, it's almost meditative. Do you find it like that?
Very much so. You know, I find myself very immersed in the experience when I'm fishing, and since I'm fiddling with the gear a lot less, I'm very much focused on being present in the moment. And for me, that is a great deal of the experience that I enjoy. I'm much more present in the sounds of the water and the nature around me, and focused on being able to actually see what the fish are doing and see the animals that are popping up around me on the bank. Pay attention to the cows that are often trying to sneak up on me, because that's just kind of a fact of life in fishing here in Wisconsin. It, to me, is a much more intimate experience with nature, because you're fishing so much closer in some cases, and you're taking so much less time to stop and fiddle with gear than you normally would.
Do you think that also makes it easier to get started when you have the prospect of heading out and doing some fishing?
Without a doubt. You know, your average Tinkara kit, you know, you've got your rod, you've got a line, a little bit of tippet, which is just basically an even smaller line, and you know, a small fly box will get you fishing. You can head out with about a half pound worth of equipment and some simple stuff and be able to catch fish. There isn't a ton of technique that you need just to get started. I can get most anglers started and catching fish with about 5 to 10 minutes worth of instruction, and that's enough to get them casting and to get the basic mechanics of getting the fish into their hands after they get it on the hook. And from there, you're able to actually get out and start fishing. So you don't really need to invest in all of the extras and the doodads and thingamabobs that really kind of plague you when you're trying to get set up to do other types of fishing.
Right, the casting, I've heard, in traditional fly fishing can be kind of hard. You have to kind of really get the line way out there. Is it easier to do that with Tinkara?
Yes, the basic cast in Tinkara is a very kind of basic forward cast, where you're doing a very intuitive forward snap that's going to get that cast about 20 to 25 feet out in front of you. And it's so easy. Like I said, it typically takes 5 to 10 minutes to get most people doing it effectively. But it's so easy that you hand it to most kids that they'll have it down within minutes, because they just grasp, you know, how to throw it. We've even got a customer who last summer was able to hand a rod to his two-year-old, and his two-year-old, within a few minutes, was effectively catching little bluegill on his own without really even doing anything other than watching his older brother do it. So I think it's just a basic thing that most humans understand kind of how to point and aim a stick with a string on it, and you don't have to do too much more than that if you don't want to take it any further.
I guess the proof is in the pudding, kind of the fish pudding in this case. Do you catch as many fish with Tenkara as you do fly fishing?
Well, you certainly can. In fact, we took Tenkara fly fishing to the Boy Scout National Jamboree this summer in West Virginia. It was the first time that the style of fishing was introduced to the organization at large. And Tenkara far out caught the Western fly fishing gear there on the lake. So we had records that we were able to easily outperform the conventional gear. And I think that's largely, honestly, because there's so much less fiddling with the equipment that in Tenkara the fly is in the water more. And, you really can't catch fish without fly in the water. So I think that's really why it does outperform given the time to do it.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That was Matt Smen, co-owner of Badger Tenkara, talking about why the Japanese style of fly fishing, Tenkara, is becoming more popular here in Wisconsin.
Now, for a person living with a disability, accomplishing what seems like a small task can sometimes be very time-consuming. Meeting a work deadline or going out with friends for a quick bite to eat, these things might not always be doable.
Ellen Samuels has a rare genetic disease. She recently wrote about her struggle in Disability Studies Quarterly. She's an associate professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison and the author of Fantasies of Identification, Disability, Gender, Race. Ellen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, your essay talks about living life in what you call crip time. Can you explain in your own words what is crip time?
Well, crip time is kind of an in-group expression that some disabled people use amongst ourselves. And originally, it just meant being late. When you're disabled, there's a lot of reasons that you might be late, right? But in recent years, some of us have been talking about it more as this sense of when time becomes flexible, when time becomes what your body needs or what your mind needs instead of the time that the outside world tells you to have. And my friend Allison Kafer, in her wonderful book, Feminist Queer Crip, says queer crip time is flex time, not just expanded, but exploded.
And you write that it can be, on the one hand, this beautiful thing and about giving your body the space, sort of for time to bend around what your body needs, but on the other hand, something that also holds grief and loss and alienation, all these things within it.
Yes, absolutely. That was what I wrote about in this essay. Is I said, I'm going to take a moment and talk about crip time in a different way than we've been talking about it, and talk about the ways it involves loss and brokenness. And that's not to contradict the ways that it's beautiful and forgiving, but that we have to hold both.
Can you tell us a little bit about what living your life, since it sounds like your 20s in what you call crip time, what it meant for you?
Well, I was in my 20s when I started to not be able to do the things other people my age could do. First, I couldn't use my hands. Then I couldn't walk. Then I was just very sick and in pain and losing weight, and no one knew why. And it took a long time after that. It took almost 15 years for them to discover that I had this rare genetic disorder called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And really, I'd had it my whole life, but it was in my 20s that it began to really disrupt my life. And at that point, I felt that I moved out of the time of my peers and into a new time, a time when I often felt I had more in common with people in their 70s or 80s who were struggling to hold on to their independence, who were struggling with fatigue and pain the way that I was.
And you write really openly, really honestly about how you feel. And there's a story you tell about swimming in the warm water pool with some of these people who are in their 70s and their 80s. And at one point you say, really frankly, I hate them. Can you tell us what's going through your mind then?
I thought you might ask about that. That's probably the moment I was most nervous about publishing in this essay, when I said, I go to the pool, in the warm water pool. Everyone else is much older than me. They frequently ask me, why are you here? What's wrong with you? And I tell them, and then they tell me about their lives. And I don't often admit this, but I hate them because they want me to be sympathetic about what they've lost. But what they've lost is what I lost decades and decades before, and they don't see it. And that, I say, is the privilege of not living in crip time. You've had a life of normal time. You've had a life of the stages we expect people to have, and I didn't have that. And I'll tell you, of all the, and this essay has had, I've been so touched by the response it's gotten. I did not expect it to get such a wide and public response. And people, strangers, are writing to me from all over the country. And that's the number one thing that they say, is they say, thank you, I hate them too, in some context or another.
So it's opening a conversation, it sounds like, that hasn't been said before. I've never heard people write like this before. We've interviewed many guests on this program, and no one has spoken quite, you know, in that raw, this is exactly what I'm feeling, this is my experience, and I'm just going to say it. Do you think that's opened some doors for honest conversations in a sense that we haven't had before, ever, maybe?
I think every time someone tells a truth that hasn't been told before, they find out that there's thousands of other people holding that same truth. And that's absolutely what's happened with this essay for me.
And in your essay, you take us back to the summer of 1995 when your your genetic disease took a turn for the worse. Can you tell us a little bit about your disability and how you live day to day now?
Absolutely. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is a connective tissue disorder. It's caused by a defect in collagen, which is one of the main proteins that builds our bodies. And so it's in every system. So it affects every system. I often describe it as everything's too loose, everything's too weak. It's like a push puppet, if you know what those are, those dolls, and their joints are held together by string and you push the bottom and they collapse. So my joints are like that. They're what medically it's called hypermobility. And so my body is working so hard all day to keep me together. Even when I'm just sitting here talking to you, my body is putting out the energy that a regular person's body puts out to run a marathon. And as a result, I get the injuries that athletes get. I get the injuries wrestlers get. I get the injuries that gymnasts get, but I get them just from turning over in bed.
We're talking right now with Ellen Samuels, an associate professor of gender and women's studies at UW-Madison. She's talking about her essay that describes how people with disabilities often accomplish tasks at a very different speed and experience the world around them very differently. And it's something that she and others call crip time. And Ellen, in your piece, you describe how you decided to pursue academia as a career. You thought, well, maybe I can't really work a 9-to-5 job like maybe I thought I could, so I'm going to go back to school, pursue a life as an academic. And you describe lying under the desks during the lectures to get through them, but also finding there, I mean, some joy and happiness at what you were doing, even though you say you were alone. Is that an example of what you've had to do to say, you know what, this is what my body needs, so this is what I'm going to do?
Right. It's really quite astonishing when you think about the wide range of people's abilities and needs that were so wedded to the 9-to-5, 40-hour-a-week schedule. And being in my 20s, I couldn't do those jobs anymore. I couldn't do things like waitressing, which is what I'd done to get through high school. And I thought, what can I do? I can read and I can write and I can teach people about reading and writing. I know how to do that. And when I went back to graduate school to do that, I discovered that even though I was still so different from my peers, I was still in a very different time from them. It was a time that I could make work. If I needed to write all night and sleep all day, I could do that.
And looking at the concept of time, I think that's one thing that really comes out into stark relief is the way, you know, time for someone who might not be struggling with a disability unfolds in this very linear way in general. And the body goes through predictable stages, as you said, getting to 70, 80 and starting to lose some of that mobility. And you've had to experience some of that sooner. And it's made you think about how you wish there were alternate versions of time. You wish you could kind of switch, like code switch back between different loops of time and experience things. In general, has it changed the way that you think about time and how it functions in your own life?
Thank you for that question. I think about this all the time. I didn't mean that as a pun, but I think about it every day when I am going through my day and I'm organizing it differently from other people. I work for an hour and I rest for an hour, or maybe I work for an hour and I rest for the rest of the day. And I constantly have voices in my head saying, you're wasting time. And then I have another voice that says, no, this is my time. I'm living on crypt time.
Do you think that time as we think of it has to, in a mainstream sense, for someone without a disability, do you think it has to unfold that way? Our society has to be structured that way? Or would there be a way to make it more flexible? Not just for you, but for everybody. Is there a way to be more time sensitive? It's not a concept I've ever thought of before until I read your piece, but is there a way to make time a little more bendy to accommodate people?
There are already so many efforts to do that, I would say. I mean, just the concept of flex time, which we often think of as accommodating parents, but it just accommodates people with different kinds of bodies, different kind of minds, different ways that they care for themselves and care for others. And I think we need so much more of that. And I think the resistance to it is not a rational resistance, because I mean, I'm not an expert, but I think there's a lot of research showing flex time increases productivity and it increases morale. And, you know, recently I was listening to NPR and hearing about, you know, another study showing that teenagers do better if their school starts later, and yet no one is having their school start later. And it's because we have this weird morality about time. We think you have to work certain times in certain ways to be a good person or to be a productive person. But any of us can look around in our lives and see that's not true.
We're talking with Ellen Samuels. She's an associate professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison, talking about how people with disabilities experience time differently, accomplish tasks at a different speed often than the world around them, and it's something she calls crip time.
Do you identify with this concept? Are you living with a disability? Do you set aside more time to accomplish tasks through your day? Call in at 800-642-1234. And how has your workplace responded to your disability? How about family, friends, strangers? Do they understand what it takes to be you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about living with a disability and the time and energy it takes to live in a world that's skewered toward people without disabilities. Ellen Samuels stays with us. She wrote an essay in Disability Studies Quarterly about this. She's an associate professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison.
You can join in and maybe talk about your experiences living with a disability at 800-642-1234. Do you relate to what Ellen says about what she calls crip time? What advice do you have for people who don't live with a disability to help them better understand what you're going through every day? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Ellen, you've written this essay, which you've gotten this tremendous response to. You are a writer, and now it sounds like you also have an outlet through poetry. And I know you brought a few poems in for us. Could you read a few and share those?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. So in the past year, I've been quite ill, and I've been spending a lot of time in medical testing, treatments, procedures. It has not left me the time to do the kind of intensive research writing I often do. So instead, I've started writing poetry in my head. I've been writing poetry for decades now, but these new poems, they're very short, and I actually write them in my head while I'm having medical procedures. And I have almost a whole book of them now. It's called Immobilities, and I'll just read three from that. Oh, I'll explain. A joint subluxation is when a joint partially dislocates and goes back in.
Okay.
The difference between joint subluxation and dislocation. Door unlatched in the body house. Shutter to slow kiss the jam or slam. Hmm. This next one is, I often injure myself while I'm asleep, and that's what this is about. Ankle sprain while sleeping. Warm swell of pain, foot knuckle bruising. What dance did you dream and forget? And the last one is about genetic testing for the genetic defect I have that causes Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Genetic testing for the COL5A1 mutation. One letter typed wrong. One plate chipped. Blood deep in you. one petal drifting.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing those. Those are beautiful, and it also gives me a window, like the essay does, into what you're thinking and what life is like. Thinking about the dream dances that might injure a foot is something that you might not realize, and you've got it in poetry form there. And I want to take a caller now on this conversation. We've got Mark joining us in Green Bay. Mark, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What do you want to share?
Well, I just wanted to ask your guest, the first time I guess I've really heard this topic discussed under this framework. I too have a chronic disability for many, many years, since I think 1995, your guest said she was first diagnosed. And, you know, a lot of chronic fatigue and a lot of, you know, I've never used this word crip time, I guess, but it certainly rings true with my personal experience. One of the more large issues that I've dealt with is how to deal with the frustration and explaining that crip time to the outside world. Because oftentimes, understandably so, you know, people just don't relate with that concept. They see it as excuses or, you know, in my case, I look relatively healthy, but there's, you know, there's some obvious physical disability if they're observant enough, and certainly a lot of chronic fatigue that come along that require you to kind of, you know, frame your daily life around that, work life, personal life, things of this nature. I just wonder if she had any comments about that.
Great. Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate you calling up and sharing what your experience is, too. And Ellen, what advice do you have for Mark? He wants to know how to explain his sense of time and what you call crip time to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I really appreciate you asking this question, Mark. It's such a struggle for me and for so many of us with chronic illnesses, especially when they're not really apparent or visible. I have two suggestions. If it's someone in your life who you know who's willing to put in a little bit of time and thought, there's this wonderful essay called The Spoon Theory. By a woman named Christine Miserando. And if you just Google the spoon theory, it will come up, that talks about living with chronic illness as having only so many spoons. And once you run out of spoons, you're done for the day. And healthy people might have 20 spoons, but we only have 5. And maybe just showering and getting dressed and eating takes 3 of our spoons. If it's someone you don't know as well, someone who's not going to read this and start understanding it in that way, then I would say, don't make excuses. Don't apologize. Just say, this is what I can do and can't do. And some people will accept it. Some people will ask more, and you can tell them about your experience. And some people won't. And I think one of the hardest lessons for us to learn is that's their problem. It's not ours.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for calling, and I hope that helps. And Ellen, do you see a future as you start to talk openly about this? Mark joins the conversation, more conversations start happening at a national level, where what you call crip time is something that is understood, first of all, by everybody, and is made so you're not just the one flexing around the time, but other people are helping you.
I do. I am optimistic. I think there's still a lot of change that needs to be made and a lot of struggles, but I think it's something that joins us with other people, with working parents. I look at my students today and they give me so much optimism for the future. They're facing a difficult future, much more difficult than I faced at their age or than my parents faced. And they're so generous and hopeful and hardworking and sensitive to these issues. And so it does give me a lot of hope.
Ellen, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Really appreciate it today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talking there with Ellen Samuels in studio, an associate professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison. She recently wrote an essay in Disability Studies Quarterly about getting by in a world designed for people who don't have disabilities and what her experience of time is like. She calls it crip time.
Over the last 20 years, mining for minerals, things like copper and gold in Wisconsin, has been effectively banned by state law. But an effort to bring back this kind of mining is starting to pick up steam in the state legislature, and it's reopening decades-old fault lines between environmentalists and industrial groups. Rich Kramer has this report.
A mile south of Ladysmith, along the Flambeau River, a small group of lawmakers, environmentalists, and curious citizens are touring the remains of the state's only metallic sulfide mine operated under modern regulations. What was once a deep open pit is now rolling prairie lined with miles of hiking trails. Ladysmith City Administrator Al Christensen led the way.
The original plan here was to mine for 5 years. Because copper prices were quite high during the course of the mine, it was decided to expedite it, and it was pretty well mined out to a depth of about 225 feet in a period of 4.25 years.
The Flambeau mine produced copper, silver, and gold. It was controversial from the start because it processed rock loaded with minerals called sulfides, which when exposed can pollute water. At the time, fear of sulfide mining was so strong that when a larger project was proposed in Crandon by Exxon, a bipartisan group of lawmakers passed a bill that has blocked sulfide mines to this day. Democratic Assemblyman Spencer Black authored the bill. In a 1997 interview on Wisconsin Public Television, he said it was about putting the brakes on an overeager industry.
Those minerals have been there hundreds of millions of years. They're going to be there a few years more. And we should make sure that we don't put our environment and our economy at risk.
The Crandon mine never got off the ground, and the new law became known as the mining moratorium. It required mining companies to give examples of sulfide mines that had operated for 10 years or had been closed for 10 years without polluting in order to get a permit to operate in Wisconsin. It was hailed as a major victory by environmentalists and a substantial blow to the mining industry. Now, nearly 20 years after the passage of the mining moratorium, Republican State Senator Tom Tiffany is pushing to repeal the law. His bill is titled the Mining for America Act, and it would let companies seek mining permits without providing examples of clean mines first. Tiffany says sulfide mining can be done safely, and it would bring a billion-dollar industry to a part of the state that sorely needs it.
And I believe that we can do this appropriately. I believe the Flambeau mine in Ladysmith is a perfect example of how we can mine for non-ferrous minerals safely.
Environmentalists are using the Flambeau mine as an example, too. They say it has polluted the Flambeau River and sued the mine company over alleged violations of the Clean Water Act. According to the State Department of Natural Resources, a stream on the property is polluted by copper and zinc, but the source is officially unknown. At a rally held the night before the public hearing on Senator Tiffany's bill, Laura Gauger, who was part of the lawsuit against the Flambeau mine, warned of what was to come.
The stakes are really high on this one. If the industry couldn't protect the water at the tiny, state-of-the-art Flambeau mine that doesn't even have a tailings dam, what hope is there for the waters at the much larger metal sulfide mines coming down the pipe if the mining moratorium law is repealed?
The next morning at the Ladysmith High School auditorium, dozens of people testified for and against Tiffany's bill. George Meyer, who served as DNR secretary when the moratorium was passed, said it frustrated regulators because environmental impacts from sulfide mining are very site-specific. He said when Exxon wanted to mine in the headwaters of the Wolf River, they gave examples of what they claimed were clean mines in Arizona, northern Canada, and California.
None of them provided any valuable information on how we should mine in Forest County, Wisconsin. But our staff did get to see some beautiful places.
Tiffany's bill to repeal Wisconsin's sulfide mining moratorium hasn't been scheduled for any votes yet. He hopes to pass it before the end of the year. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.